It's Philosophy Talk.
10 months ago, our leader suffered a horrible accident.
Could an education that focuses on good character create virtuous leaders?
The emergency department rushed to the scene of the accident immediately, but all that remained of him was this. This is our leader's nose.
Could we educate our leaders to have better character?
Good luck with that. Most politicians these days are power-hungry, corrupt, and out of touch.
So let's train them to be less selfish.
You think good character is something that can be taught?
You have a better idea?
Our dream has been that by cloning, we would reproduce our leader in perfect tact from his nose.
Nobody's looking for a saint or for somebody who is absolutely perfect.
Our guest is Massimo Piliucci, author of The Quest for Character.
The unity of virtues is not an empirical matter, it's an aspirational matter.
How to create virtuous leaders.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Do good leaders have to be good people?
What qualities should we expect in our politicians?
How can we build character in our next generation of leaders?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about how to create virtuous leaders.
That's a great idea, Ray. We sure could use some leaders who tell the truth, accept basic science, and, you know, do their jobs instead of lining their pockets.
Yeah, you know, I agree we need all of those things. But do we really need our leaders to be good people on top of that? Like, I don't care if they cheat on their partners or go on shopping sprees with their own money or party hard on the weekends, as long as they just do their jobs. Asking them to be virtuous in addition, that's kind of a high bar, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, would you trust someone who's dishonest and corrupt in their private life to behave any differently when they have access to huge amounts of public money? They don't have to be saints, but I think they should at least be decent human beings. Is that really too much to ask?
Okay, fine. There's a minimum bar, sure, but there really have been amazing leaders with serious flaws. Like, people say that Martin Luther King cheated on his wife. But, you know, even if that's true, it doesn't take away anything from his leadership in the civil rights movement. And, you know, you can be a nice person, but a lousy leader, too. Al Gore really cared about the environment, but he was so dorky and awkward that he couldn't get enough votes to actually get elected.
Well, maybe there are some exceptions to the rule, but I still think, in general, you have to be a good person to be a good politician.
Yeah, I don't think that's true at all, Josh. A good politician needs confidence verging on arrogance and strategic truth-telling verging on dishonesty and decisiveness to the point of being tyrannical and the kind of charisma that can just easily lead into narcissism.
Well, look, okay, maybe those are the kinds of people who get elected, but the leaders we actually need, they're the people who don't campaign for power. Like T'Challa in the movie Black Panther. He didn't really want to lead the world outside Wakanda, but, you know, he was a good person, and he rose to the occasion when he saw that the world needed help.
We're talking about real people, Josh, not comic book superheroes.
Well, okay, but philosophers back me up too, Ray. I mean, think about Plato's Republic. In Plato's Republic, Socrates says the best leaders, they're not the ones who are motivated by an interest in power. They're the ones who are motivated by a sense of duty.
Yeah? How did that work out for Plato, Josh? You know, he tried to train King Dionysius, the elder of Syracuse, and that guy sold him into slavery. And then after his friends freed him, he came back and he tried to train King Dionysius the Younger, and he taught little Dionysius all about virtue and philosophy, but it did absolutely no good. That kid betrayed his uncle, mismanaged his kingdom, and ended up getting exiled by his own people.
That's not Plato's fault. He did his best. And no teacher in the world could have turned little Dionysius into a decent ruler. He just wasn't cut out for it. As Immanuel Kant would say, out of such crooked timber, nothing straight can be made.
Okay, what's the good of education if it's not going to make people better, though? Even if it's not harmful, it seems like trying to teach people to be virtuous is kind of pointless.
I don't think we should give up too soon. I mean, you look at you. You're teaching our future leaders all about virtue and responsibility. Why would you do that if it didn't make any sense?
Okay, I'm not training them as future leaders. I'm training them as citizens. If some of those citizens gain political power, I really hope it'll have done them some good, but I'm not really sure how much I can expect.
Well, maybe our guest will persuade you to be a little more optimistic. It's our old friend Massimo Pilucci from the City University of New York. And he's got a new book called The Quest for Character, which is all about leaders and virtue.
But first, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to find out how leaders from conquering kings to President Jimmy Carter have cultivated their images as virtuous people. She files this report.
It's very easy to get a list of rulers who are villainous or greedy or whatever.
Sean Lang is a lecturer at Anglia Ruskin University, and he compiled a list of rulers who were bad leaders but pleasant people. You know, solid dinner companions.
I order you to be quiet!
His roundup of eight of the nicest kings in history includes King Louis XVI of France, who was sent to the guillotine during the French Revolution.
Off with his hand!
I'm not saying that niceness leads to your being executed, but it begins to look that way when you're the ruler.
Lang says Louis XVI took his duty as king very seriously, but he also wanted to be loved by everyone. During his rule in the second half of the 18th century, France faced an economic crisis and people were starving. A string of finance ministers told him to tax the nobles and the church.
And when the nobles say, "Don't you dare tax us," what does the king do? Does he sort of say, "No, I stand by my minister"? He says, "Oh, well, no, quite right, I don't want to cause any trouble," and so he sacks the minister.
The king's eventual fate is shown on the TV show Family Guy.
Look, Louis, the French people really want to thank you for your services as king, but it's just not working out, and we've decided to go another way.
Other people on Lang's list?
Nicholas II of Russia. If you're thinking, is he the one who gets overthrown in the revolution? Yep, he was. And Charles I of England. Was he the one who got overthrown in the Civil War? Yes, he was.
So that's kings and czars for you. Next up, U.S. presidents, or one U.S. president in particular.
Honestly, I had never really heard that much about Jimmy Carter, other than perhaps the fact that he was becoming a great ex-president.
Amber Rosner is author of the book Jimmy Carter and the Birth of the Marathon Media Campaign. If you ask people who was the nicest U.S. president, they may well answer Jimmy Carter. Rosner says when Carter ran for president in 1976, his campaign team crafted his image.
In particular, a peanut farmer turned nuclear physicist that promised to never tell a lie and to deliver a government as good as the American people.
Jimmy Carter knows what it's like to work for a living. Until he became governor, he put in 12 hours a day in his shirt sleeves during harvest at his farm. Can you imagine any of the other candidates for president working in the hot August sun?
Carter ran during a credibility crisis in American politics in the wake of Vietnam and Watergate. He appeared in carefully staged events.
Some of the central backdrops to the campaign were Plains Baptist Church, where Carter taught the men's Sunday school class. And also, they spent a lot of time at the local softball field there, actively playing games with the press. And then also at fishing ponds.
But maintaining a virtuous image is tricky. In a 1976 interview with Playboy magazine, Carter famously described lusting for women and said he committed adultery in his heart many times.
Some scholars and cultural observers of that campaign would say almost lost Carter the election.
But it didn't. Carter won. By 1979, though, the country was experiencing high unemployment, inflation, and an energy crisis.
It's clear that the true problems of our nation are much deeper, deeper than gasoline lines or energy shortages, deeper even than inflation or recession.
That year, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, U.S. diplomats and citizens were taken hostage in Iran, and there was the incident with the killer rabbit. Jimmy Carter was in a boat, fishing in Plains, Georgia, when he said a rabbit leapt in the water and swam towards him. This incident is mocked on Saturday Night Live in a scene where he meets with Fidel Castro.
I can see being attacked by a dog, or a fox, or a hedgehog. A chicken can become quite angry, even a wild pig. But a rabbit, that's crazy.
Carter's staff didn't buy this story, and that went against his image as an honest president. But photos show it really did happen.
This is a moment in which the film Jaws had just premiered. And so one of the most famous images is of Paws. So this rabbit that's attacking Carter. And it became kind of a larger metaphor for Carter's failed presidency.
I haven't met Jimmy Carter, but he seems genuinely virtuous. He's done a lot of good things for the planet and mankind since his presidency, like set up the Carter Center to eradicate disease, promote free and fair elections across the globe. He's given back to the public through Habitat for Humanity.
Really kind of practicing what he preaches. And you don't really see that a lot, certainly not in American politics.
Jimmy Carter, look, he was a nice man. He was a terrible president.
But maybe we can try to have both. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that fascinating report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're thinking about how to create virtuous leaders.
We're joined now by Massimo Pigliucci. He's professor of philosophy at the City University of New York and a prolific author, most recently of The Quest for Character, What the Story of Socrates and Alcibiades Teaches Us About Our Search for Good Leaders. Massimo, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Last time you were here, Massimo, we were talking to you about physics. Now you're writing about leadership. Why has that been on your mind lately?
Well, in the meantime, I went through a little bit of a midlife crisis. And in the process of dealing with it, I rediscovered the Greco-Romans. And then I remember, oh, these people still have a lot to teach us 2 millennia later. And one of the things that they teach us is about character and leadership. So here we are.
So nothing to do with recent leaders?
Not at all. Why are you asking?
So you say that the Greeks have a lot to teach us. Why should we look to the past to solve the problems of today?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and it's a very fair one. So I would say, as a scientist, if you wanted to learn about physics or biology, don't pick up Aristotle. If you're interested in the history of physics and biology, that's fine, but not if you want to do current stuff. On the other hand, if you're interested in ethics and justice and politics, then the Greco-Romans still have a lot to teach us because, you know, human nature has not changed that much in the intervening 2,000 years. It's the same reason we have still a lot to learn from other ancient traditions such as Buddhism or Taoism or Confucianism.
So if I wanted to be sort of obstreperous and object, I might say, look, society has changed so much in the last 2,000 years. You know, we have giant nation states. We have technologies that the Greeks and the Romans could not have imagined. But it sounds like there's some, like, enough commonalities that we can still learn from their ethics and politics. So why is there still enough commonalities, even with all this, like, technological and societal change?
Because I think we tend to overestimate the import of those changes. Technologically, you're absolutely right. I mean, if, let's say, Socrates were coming back today and we're looking at the way in which the three of us are communicating right now, you know, across thousands of miles and with electronic gadgets, you would say, what the hell is going on here? But on the other hand, as soon as then he settled down and started listening to what we were saying, he would definitely recognize our conversation and would have something to say. And the reason for that is that, yes, we have nation states instead of city states, but guess what? We still go after each other for resources, for fame, for glory. We still have the same basic fears and wants and needs. And that's why this whole thing is still relevant.
And so you think that what made a good leader in the ancient world, so it's the same thing today. What makes a good leader today? Same thing?
Well, pretty much, because the challenge is essentially the same. You know, what does it mean to be a leader? You know, leading whom and where?
Okay, and then so who would be, if you wanted to pick your number one, you know, successful and virtuous leader from the ancient world, who would that be?
Probably Marcus Aurelius, who was also a Stoic practitioner. And, you know, he was one of the so-called five good emperors that lived during the peak of Roman power. And he had a pretty difficult time. He had to face a series of floods and earthquakes that affected Rome and some other major cities. He had two frontier defensive wars to fight. He had an internal rebellion. His wife was cheating on him. And he had a plague that killed more than 2 million people. Even so, he tried his best to manage these issues and pretty much succeeded, by and large.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about leadership and virtue with Massimo Piliucci from the City University of New York.
Have you ever been in a leadership role? What qualities were important to your success? Do you have to be good to be effective?
Virtue, vigor, or a vision? Along with your comments and questions when Philosophy Talk continues. In a world gone wrong, how do we create leaders with great spirit? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about how to create virtuous leaders with Massimo Piliucci from the City University of New York, author of The Quest for Character.
Got questions about what makes a good leader? Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org or comment on our website. And while you're there, you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
So, Massimo, you've told us that political leaders have to be virtuous people in order to be good leaders. What specific virtues do you think they should have?
Well, the basic ones are the so-called cardinal four, which are practical wisdom, courage, justice, and temperance.
Okay, I think I understand what courage and justice are. Temperance is something like self-control, don't drink too much and things like that. But what's practical wisdom?
Practical wisdom, which in Latin is prudentia, prudence, and in Greek is phronesis, basically refers to the knowledge of what is really, truly good and what is not good, so that you can use that knowledge as a compass to navigate the world, and also to knowledge of how to best navigate your way to the good. So it's really knowledge of what is valuable and how to get there.
Okay, so there are two parts, and it seems like they're kind of separate. So knowledge of how to navigate my way, it seems like I could be a real selfish jerk and be really great at getting my way and manipulating people and, like, controlling objects. But, like, knowledge of what is good, how do I get that? Does it have anything to do with the other one?
it does, according to the Greco-Romans, because most of them, beginning with Socrates, believed in something called the unity of virtues. That is, you really can't be, for instance, courageous and unjust at the same time, because both courage and justice have an inherent ethical component to it. So courage is not just, bravery in battle. It's bravery in battle when you know that you're fighting for the right cause, that sort of stuff. So all of the four cardinal virtues are actually connected to each other. And that means that, in terms of your other question, there is a deep connection between knowing where you want to go and how to get there, because you don't only want to go somewhere that is good, you also want to get there in a way that is good, that is virtuous.
I'm really curious about the unity of the virtues, partly because it seems like I can observe counterexamples, but maybe they're not counterexamples. Like, I think the world has had, like, brave Confederate soldiers or people who got drunk a lot but were really generous to their friends. And it seems like the unity of virtues says that shouldn't happen. Am I misinterpreting those examples? Or is there some way to, like, reconcile them?
Both. So no, you're not misinterpreting the examples, but there is a way, I think, to reconcile them. And that is exactly, notice that you use the word bravery there, right? I use the word courage, and then I qualified it. It has to be moral courage. So in other words, you can be brave, but pursuing the wrong cause, in which case you're not being virtuous. You're just being brave. You're displaying a certain kind of attitude and character, but that is not a moral one. So you cannot be, in a sense, brave or courageous by, in fact, pursuing the wrong cause, not in the way in which the Greco-Romans define courage.
But what about temperance? Okay, so we think about folks who maybe drink a little too much, or maybe they're unfaithful to their partner, things like this. Surely there have been lots of politicians, including benign ones, perhaps even, forces for good, Ray mentioned one of them when we were having a conversation at the beginning of this show. Is it really true that there's a unity of virtue such that a person who is good in the rest of their life, an effective leader, bringing about a better life for everyone else, they're definitely going to also be temperate, not drink very much, abstemious, always self-controlled when it comes to romantic relationships and things like that? I mean, does this really have to go together?
Well, so the unity of virtues is not an empirical matter. It's an aspirational matter. So, yes, absolutely, you're right. There are people who are certainly imperfect and yet partially virtuous, right? Somewhat virtuous. And we'll take them. That's fine. But partial virtue is better than no virtue at all.
But is that the one that matters? I mean, when I think about what I want from my leaders, I mean, I certainly want moral bravery, as you were saying, and I want justice, absolutely, right? They should really care about other people and bringing about a better world for as many people as possible. I wouldn't mind if they were honest. Both of my countries were recently run by people who had a bit of a problem around telling the truth.
Politicians lying? Say it ain't so, Josh.
I know, it's shocking. But you know, this
never heard
of that. Beyond just the usual spin, right? So, but I don't think, you know, maybe this is the part of me that, you know, I spend a lot of time in French departments, so maybe that's this part of me speaking. But I don't think I need my politician to be a family person, right? I don't necessarily need to care what they do in their private life, how many partners they have, things like that. Aren't there some virtues that are just more important than others when it comes to the kind of politician that we need, the kind of person we need our politicians to be?
Yeah, actually, even the Greco-Romans agreed that some virtues are more fundamental than others. For instance, the Stoic Musonius Rufus thought that temperance actually is the most important, because if you're not temperate, you're not going to be able to do anything else, because you're always going to be going around drinking and eating to your heart's content. Plato, on the other hand, thought that practical wisdom is the most fundamental one. So yes, they're not all created equal, but the general idea is that there is a spillover effect. That is, if you have somebody who is a leader and it cheats on his wife or otherwise, you know, doesn't pay taxes or something like that, well, statistically speaking, you can bet on the fact that that sort of behavior will spill into other areas. We don't compartmentalize things that clearly. If we're not good in our private lives, chances are we're also going to make similar kind of mistakes in public life.
Okay, so ideally, I would like to have perfectly virtuous politicians. But looking at the pool that we have to draw from, I mean, if we're going to have politicians, we're going to have politicians who aren't like perfectly virtuous people, because there just aren't enough virtuous people. Like, realistically, how much virtue can I hope for?
More than we have, a little bit at least, because I think we have been, I mean, one of the arguments in the book is that we have actually let things to the point where our bar has gone so low that now we, at least in semi-democratic societies like the United States, we deserve what we get. I mean, we have the kind of politicians that we put in there in the first place. So nobody's looking for a saint or for somebody who is absolutely perfect. You know, even the Stoics themselves thought that the sage, the ideal Stoic, it only appears once every 500 years. So it's not like you can't count on that to run regular society, regular life. But a little bit better than what we've been doing recently. Yeah, that's not unreasonable.
I agree, but I also worry. I mean, why are we in the predicament we're in? Obviously, there are many reasons, but I worry that it's partly to do with the system and not just, I mean, I agree with Ray that there aren't maybe that many folks to choose from, but I also think it has to do with the incentive structure. Within the realm of leadership, particularly political leadership, so that the wrong people run for office, right? Because there's strong disincentives for good people to run, and there are strong incentives for less good people to run.
Correct. So it's both an issue of priorities in us, the voters, the people, and also structural issues. This research that shows, for instance, that the two professions with the highest frequency of sociopathic characters are politics and high finance.
Oh, wow.
This may come as a shock.
Yeah, right.
Right? So yeah, those are structural. We really have the wrong people running for these positions, especially in politics. But it's also a question of our choices and our priorities. For instance, we do not teach virtue to our kids. with very, very few exceptions. And one of the best exceptions I've seen recently is a documentary actually called Young Plato, which is set in Belfast in Northern Ireland, where principal of an elementary school is using day-to-day occurrences that are relevant to these kids to teach them philosophy and ethics in particular. And guess what? He mostly draws from the Greco-Romans, Socrates and the Stoics. And it's fascinating to see. So the question is, well, why don't we do that on a regular basis everywhere?
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about leadership and virtue with Massimo Piliucci from the City University of New York. And we have an email from Harold. Harold says, we try to instill virtue in our youth, but by the time they reach the age of majority, they realize exactly how competitive they need to be to make a life. Virtue slips away as an anachronism. Nice to talk about, impractical in a fast-paced modern world. So that seems like a direct challenge to what you were just saying. You stick the students in these young Plato academies, but then they get out of the academies and they enter the world and that all slips away. What do you think, Massimo?
Well, I kind of reject the empirical premise. I mean, when the email starts out by saying we teach virtue to our kids. No, we don't. When was the last time we've seen that? Most of the times we don't. So if the empirical premise is incorrect, then the rest, as you know, doesn't follow.
I am curious to know what teaching virtue to our kids ought to look like.
Oh, that's a great question. So there are certain things that work and other things that don't work, not only that were proposed by the ancient Greco-Romans, but also that are confirmed by modern empirical science. For instance, one thing that doesn't work is virtue labeling. To tell people that they're good and brilliant, you know, kids, that they're, oh, you're so good, you're so brilliant, when they're not, actually doesn't work. In fact, it long term undermines the whole point. But one of the things that does work is to expose people on purpose to situations that train them to be responding in a more virtuous way, in a way that actually is similar to an analogy that was made by Protagoras, or a sophist of all people, in a dialogue with Socrates, where he says, look, teaching virtue is like teaching a musical instrument. It is a matter of understanding a little bit of theory, you know, musical notation and stuff. It is a matter of having a good teacher because he or she can confirm your technique or correct it. And then mostly it's about practice, right? And in the case of music, you know, some of us are more prone by nature to play musical instruments, and some of us are not, but we can all improve by practicing.
My brother has kids, and I sort of watch him and his wife bring up the kids. And I noticed that they do seem to be doing some, like, trying to teach virtue. So you know, they'll say things like, oh, we share our toys. You can't hit your sister. And just practice ways of treating others with respect. And they correct when the kids do something that they shouldn't be doing, and they kind of demonstrate how to respect each other. Isn't that a way of teaching virtue?
Oh, it sure is. And sure enough, I actually believe, I'm a little bit more of an optimist, I suppose, but I do believe that most people are decent people when they become adults. As I said, it's sociopaths who get into politics. So I think that you're right, that does work. But of course, parents themselves don't have a particularly deep understanding or training in virtue themselves, because where did they get it? They got it from their own parents. So there is nothing, seems like, extraordinary in proposing that, you know, we could do better for the next generation by training the parents, not just the kids.
Okay, so I totally want to believe you. But in your book, you
Thank
cite
you.
A couple of cases where it didn't go so well, right? Ray earlier mentioned the case of Plato going to Syracuse and trying, you know, you can't say Plato didn't know what was going on with virtues. And he tried pretty hard to instill some virtues into these two rulers of Syracuse. And you've got the case of Seneca with Nero. So, you know, if those folks can't succeed, what hope is there for the rest of us?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. It is kind of surprising that Plato even tried with the two Dionysuses, because he ought to know better. I mean, the ancients knew that the best time for intervening in that sense is when somebody is much younger than the two Dionysuses were when Plato got access to them. By the way, Plato did succeed with a third person, Dion, who also became a leader in Syracuse after the fall of Dionysius II. And Dion actually did much better. But the difference with Dion is that Dion actually was a student of Plato since he was very young, and he wanted to become virtuous. He wanted to be a better person. And so things went a little bit better.
So I'm worried about people like this being a pretty good but not fail-safe method, and that it's not going to get everybody. And so I guess another question is, like, can you identify the people who are not going to be virtuous and just prevent them from becoming like politicians with a great deal of power?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, look, to some extent, nothing is fail-safe, right? I mean, we're talking about human nature and human psychology and sociology. So this is not fundamental physics. We're not going to get precise answers to our questions, unfortunately. And certainly, we're not going to get 100% of anything that we want to do. But yes, I do think that we can identify potentially problematic people early on. As I said, there is pretty good empirical evidence that the number of sociopaths or sociopathic kind of personalities in certain areas is way above the statistical average. And there is nothing that prevents us, unless we don't want to do it, to screen these people ahead of time and say, yeah, you know, I don't think you're actually, you should go there.
Well, yeah, we should send them into finance instead of politics.
Oh, no.
Isn't that what you were saying? Those are the two options. Keep them out of politics. We'll be better off.
Can't we teach them basket weaving or something? Something harmless.
Yeah,
that's
what
we have.
That's
we have an email from Lucy in San Francisco. Lucy says, I would contend that the vast majority of politicians seek office because they're power-hungry attention seekers who want to further their own careers. There may be some exceptions to prove the rule, but anyone hoping for truly virtuous leaders is naive at best. What do you think, Massimo?
Well, I'll take the charge of naivete, I guess. that's fine with me. But look, there are interesting cases which I discuss in the book, where Socrates actually goes around, according to Xenophon in his Memorabilia, advising potential politicians to either do it or not do it. I mean, the subtitle of the book is about Socrates and Alcibiades. Socrates very clearly told Alcibiades, don't do it. You're not the right kind of person to do it. But there are also examples that Xenophon teaches us where Socrates actually said, yeah, go ahead and do it. One of them was Charmides, for instance, who was Glaucon's son, and Glaucon himself was Plato's brother, just if you're interested in the genealogy here. And Charmides did go into politics. He was initially actually shy. He didn't want to do it. And he did pretty well. So it depends. You can have people, in this case, Socrates, I guess I can imagine easily somebody who with a philosophical and psychological background that can advise people early on and say, look, this is something that you want to do, or no, don't do it. And that would change, hopefully, the percentage of people of a certain kind that we find among politicians.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're asking about how to create virtuous leaders with Massimo Piliucci from the City University of New York, author of The Quest for Character.
Should we make our politicians take a crash course in ethics? Or should we forgive their little peccadilloes? Could being a worse person even make you a better leader?
Doing good by being bad? Plus, commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. If you found a virtuous leader, would you follow them to the ends of the earth? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Massimo Piliucci from the City University of New York, and we're thinking about how to create virtuous leaders.
Massimo, we are going to appoint you philosopher king. And I know you probably don't want that power, but that's precisely what's going to make you so good at it. So with the powers now vested in you, what is the first thing you're going to do to make sure that more politicians turn out to be virtuous people?
Well, the first thing to do would be to follow the example of that documentary that I mentioned earlier, Young Plato. That is, we should be teaching and training people, kids, in virtue since elementary and middle school. And no, we shouldn't expose them just to a crash course, because the whole point of philosophy as a way of life is that this isn't a question of, oh, you do it for a few hours a day and then you're done for a few weeks and you're done. No, yeah, it's a lifelong thing. So I would completely change the way in which we teach young kids and introduce a good amount of ethics, not just theoretical ethics, but practical ethics. Now, of course, the problem with that approach is that it will take at least 20 years to bear fruit, right? And but since I'm philosopher king, I don't have to run for re-election. I think that would work.
So right now, kids have courses in like mathematics and English, which has like reading and writing, and like hopefully Spanish if they're in the U.S. and need to be able to communicate with people. So we just have like an ethics curriculum. Is that the idea? And they'd have another class called ethics?
Yes, except that I think an ethics curriculum wouldn't really be a separate class. It would be kind of spread out throughout. It might be useful to have a certain number of hours, you know, in a week devoted specifically to ethics. But the general idea is to point out to kids that everything they do has to do with ethics. Here, I'm using the word ethics as the Greco-Romans did, not just the study of right and wrong or answering whether this particular action is right and wrong, but the study of how to live your entire life, how to set your priorities, how to do things in general. So in that sense, it's not just a specific course, it's really everywhere.
So I have a little bit of a worry about that, which is like I have opinions about how to live your entire life. And I know that like a lot of the people around me have very different opinions about how to live your entire life, such that I'm not sure that I want those opinions taught to kids. Like, if the kids were my kids and were being told things about how to live their lives that I strongly disagreed with, maybe I'd send them to a different school. So given that there's not this kind of consensus, how do we decide what to teach them about how to live their lives?
That is an excellent question. In fact, a lot of the resistance when this has been tried, a lot of the resistance to teach ethics to kids come from two sources, politicians and parents. And why is that? Because those are the authority figures that like to have control over kids. But look, you could raise the same objection, and in fact, people do, to other academic pursuits in among kids. I mean, there are lots of parents in the United States, for instance, who really don't like their kids to be exposed to science, you know, to evolutionary biology, for instance, or to the notion of the Big Bang in physics and so on and so forth. But, you know, what we do in those cases is we say, well, that's too bad. If you want public education, the kids have to be exposed to those notions because that is what it's part of the accepted general scientific outlook of things. Similarly, with ethics, I mean, do we not want our kids to question authority, to learn how to think critically, to value things like temperance and courage and justice? That seems like an odd objection on the part of a parent.
I personally agree. I think those are very important personal virtues and leadership virtues. And I, you know, I'm really delighted that, you know, to see you putting this focus, this belief in the existence of character and also the importance of character. But I have a different kind of worry, which is, you might think this is necessary but not sufficient. In other words, okay, good. Let's build our future leaders to have honesty, practical wisdom, moral bravery, a sense of justice. But don't they also need vision, right? So to be able to imagine their way into a different future, don't they also need confidence to be able to lead people, skills of coordination, eloquence, super important skill within a democracy because you don't just want them ordering people about, you want them persuading people. It seems to me there's a lot of skills that leaders need that ordinary folks like the three of us maybe don't need, right? And we don't need to be eloquent necessarily.
Well, wait, I have to stand up in front of a classroom.
Well, okay,
and
so for teaching, fair point, and you do have it. I mean, absolutely, but we're not leaders. We don't need the ability to fill a room full of supporters and galvanize them to a cause, and we have that confidence to be able to stand there and do that, and all of that, and the vision to imagine a new world. So is there really a total overlap between the set of virtues that just a regular person needs and the set that a good leader needs?
No, I think you're absolutely right. There is no total overlap. In fact, arguably one of the Greg Romans who understood this best was Cicero, who lived, you know, at the end of the Roman Republic. He was not only a philosopher, he was also a statesman, and he was a advocate. He was a lawyer. And so he understood, for instance, he disagreed vehemently with his friend Cato the Younger, who was a Stoic, and he disagreed vehemently on the kind of skill sets that is that are necessary to be a good politician. He insisted, unlike Cato, that rhetoric, the art of persuasion, is important, because otherwise, you're absolutely right, you don't get people to rally around your cause. So you want to be both virtues so that you pick the right cause, so that you pick things that are actually worth fighting for, but also you want to be persuasive. You want to actually be able to talk to people and rallying them to your cause. So absolutely, there are some skills that are specific to politics and a few other things like teaching that not necessarily everybody needs. But everybody, I think, does need a little bit of temperance and courage and justice and practical wisdom.
Yeah, I want to jump in and maybe defend you, Massimo, a little bit.
Great, thank you.
Whose side are you on?
Whichever side is losing. So if we want virtuous leaders, it doesn't seem like trying to teach leadership skills to only the people who are going to become leaders is necessarily the right way to go. Like, I think we should be teaching everybody, partly because in order to have citizens who pick the right leaders and who hold their leaders to standards once their leaders are in power, we need those citizens to be virtuous. Like, you mentioned questioning authority. And, like, one reason you might think that's really important is so that the leaders don't get just, like, power drunk and tyrannical. So I want to kind of agree with you, Massimo.
Thank you. And you know, an analogy there might be, for instance, we do teach the basics of, let's say, economics to our kids, even though very few of them are going to become economists. Well, why do you want to do that? Well, because, first of all, those skills, that knowledge will have some application in their own lives at a smaller scale, but also because we want them to understand what economists are doing and what their politicians are doing when they make large-scale economic decisions.
Okay, I want to raise another, because it's becoming way too kumbaya here, so I want to raise another challenge for you. What happens when a virtue becomes a vice, or maybe that's too strong a way of putting it, what happens when a virtue becomes an impediment to good leadership? So I can think of a couple of examples. So one is, you know, open-mindedness is a virtue, but that can lead to a lack of effectiveness. You know, authoritarian movements, tragically, are pretty likely to succeed because they keep everybody in line. And so you rally all your people behind you, and they do what you say. They vote when you tell them to vote, and they march when you tell them to march. Whereas if you're open mind, you're like, well, if you don't want to come to the march, that's okay. So that's one case where a virtue can become a liability. Here's another case that I think about quite a bit. The notion of the wartime conciliary, to quote The Godfather. So Churchill was pretty good as a leader during World War II. Not that great as a leader in peacetime. Odysseus in the Odyssey, actually, interestingly, kind of the same, at least for a while. And Coriolanus in Shakespeare. You know, some of the things that are going to make somebody a good warrior or leader in a situation, either of literal war or of metaphorical, just of conflict, might not make them a good leader in other situations, make them a worse leader in other situations. So what should we say about those cases?
Well, for a couple of things. First of all, luckily for us, we still, again, live in a sort of somewhat democratic situation. So if a leader becomes ineffective because the situation changes, we can recall him, right? Which is what the Greco-Romans themselves did, in fact. They changed leadership on a regular basis. But the other thing is, your own example point to why the Stoic Musonius Rufus, whom I mentioned earlier, thought that temperance is the most important of the virtues, right? I mean, a lot of the cases you mentioned are people who actually become intemperate. They do too much of a thing or too little of a thing, and then therefore they miss the mark. Or if you prefer, another way to put it is the way in which Aristotle thought about virtues as kind of middle points between extremes. And if you think of it that way, then you understand why it is that a virtuous behavior strikes exactly the right chord. If it's too much, then it's not virtuous anymore.
But I wonder if there's another way of characterizing it, which is that there are just some specific talents that a really good military commander has, and that really they don't translate in any meaningful way to a civilian context. And it's just as simple as that. So it's not like, well, you take the same virtue and you apply it on the battlefield, and then at home you apply it to solving the budget or something. No, it's more like, well, you know what? The talent you need to solve the budget is actually a really different one from the talent you need on the battlefield. And so maybe we can't have all the virtues bundled into one person. We're going to need good military leaders and good economists and good everything, you know, good Secretary of Education. Should we really expect that one person is going to combine all of the necessary talents and skills?
Well, I think you're making an interesting distinction, however, here between virtues and talents, what you're calling talents or skills. Now, of course, for the Greco-Romans, virtues, moral virtues, are a type of skill, and it's a techne, it's a technique, so you can learn it. But they are identified by the modifier moral precisely for that reason. You're absolutely right. Of course, something, you know, the kind of skills that make a good general effective in battle are not the same kind of skills that make for a good peacetime, leader. Nevertheless, I think we want both the general and the peacetime leader to be temperate, courageous, just, etc. We don't want our generals just to be efficient in battle. We also want them to be efficient in battle and ethical. That's the basic point.
So Massimo, we're almost out of time. So if you can leave our listeners with one piece of concrete advice about how to be virtuous leaders or encourage their leaders to be virtuous, what would you tell them?
Well, start with yourself. And one way to start with yourself is to start keeping a philosophical journal. If you want an example of that, Marcus Aurelius's Meditations are a great one. And of course, he was a leader. So start by self-analyzing, start by working on your own character. That will do two things. Not only it will make you a better person, it will also make you understand what you're looking for in a leader if you want that leader to be a better person.
Massimo, you are a person with all the virtues, including the virtue of being an excellent conversation partner. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Our guest has been Massimo Piliucci, professor of philosophy at the City University of New York and author of The Quest for Character, What the Story of Socrates and Alcibiades Teaches Us About Our Search for Good Leaders. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
So I feel really inspired by Massimo's defense of virtuous leaders, but the really idealistic part of me thinks, what would it look like if we didn't have leaders and we were just all virtuous co-creators of society? Because I think that's the world like I really dream about, and I still think that's a world with a lot of room for virtue.
Well, but in the meantime, I would definitely settle for our military commanders and our prime ministers and our presidents and everybody else. Getting a little bit more virtuous. We're going to put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog.
Now a man who leads with speed, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, when I was a boy, I was fascinated by manly men. I had a big crush on Audie Murphy, who was not only a war hero, he made westerns. Wow. I also used to collect toy soldiers and stage battles with them. The toy maker Marx had a series of warriors from the past, Roman generals in particular, painted and given a little placard to elevate their status as major guys who saved Rome's bacon in some Gallic campaign or other. There was also a Civil War series. The Confederate generals were much more dashing than Union generals. They had swords and feathers and splendid horses. Those are the aristocrats. The Confederate grunts were all barefoot, had to make their own bullets out of mud and grease. Also, it was drilled into us, what a shame it was that a handsome and noble man like Robert E. Lee was brought down by Grant, who was a slob and a drunk. I also gleaned from movies that the Southern leadership was much better educated than the South. They spoke Greek and had piano recitals and balls. They had a certain manly sadness, as if they knew their antebellum days were truly gone with the wind. Nothing to be done but read Keats and Aeschylus, then ride forth into battle. Sure, there were psycho-rebel hillbillies, but the gray elite kept them in line to defend the magnolias and bells from the rampaging Sherman staggering down upon them. The Southern leaders, too, were big on Roman generals, unlike the North, who were just ambitious bureaucrats, corrupt and incompetent and drunk, until I grew up and realized the true role of alcoholic beverages in adult decision-making. But even before that, the bloom was coming off the manly rose, the 300 Spartans. What a story that was. And a great movie with Richard Egan, remade later with Gerald Butler, had lost its appeal. 300... It was like looking over somebody's shoulder as they played a video game they couldn't win. And there was a story about the Spartan boy who had a fox under his tunic. Stopped by authorities, he let the fox gnaw at his stomach, never wincing, until he could get away. We were supposed to admire the Spartan boy, because I just couldn't do it. I felt sorry for him because he was too poor to afford a fox, I guess. But why did he want a fox in the first place? What do you do with a fox? Not like Lassie or Old Yeller. First chance he gets, he'll make a beeline for the henhouse. I grew up in the country. I know what I'm talking about. And you had Alcibiades before that, a Greek hero who defected to Sparta and then defected from Sparta to Persia and then back to Greece, and he finally died in exile in a shower of arrows. What kind of leader is that? In Shakespeare, the losers often fall on their swords or have someone hold a sword while they run into it, then lie on the ground and expire meaningfully and at length. With the Enlightenment, these lofty heroes were transmuted into Americans, English, and French. Parson Weems, the world's first unabashed secular propagandist, gave us the best-known stories about George Washington, that he chopped down a cherry tree and threw a dollar across the river. Again, the point of these stories was somewhat lost on a growing lad who just wanted to see Audie Murphy machine-gunning Germans from a flaming half-track. There's your leadership skills. Don't get me started on Oliver Cromwell and Napoleon. Nevertheless, I understand the impulse to admire and emulate leaders of olden times. Modern leaders seem somewhat paltry, puny. And maybe this is all part of what the internet tells me is the crisis of the American man. I know Elon's worried about it, Tucker Carlson. Apparently, American men have a low sperm count and a kind of blah feeling. Does Tucker Carlson, though? I bet he doesn't. He's trying to help us be more like him. Well, I don't know if manliness is worth that price. I was holding out for more of a hands-on-hip, roaring-with-laughter, Henry VIII type of manly leadership, you know? I guess in these end times, you got to take what's offered. Benefit of the doubt, maybe Tucker's got a critter underneath his blazer. You know, Tucker always seems a little bit whiny. Maybe that's because he's got a fox gnawing at his stomach. The Spartans, you never know. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2022.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Yi-Chi Shi, Merle Kessler, and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Land.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
It's got more guts and sense. That tank is loaded with gas and ammo. It'll blow up any minute.